Thank you, Andy. I did not realize exactly when Andy and I met. I couldn't have told you. I would have more likely, instead of 1981, told you it was 1900, none of your business. But it was, I've always appreciated Andy. I think we probably met, if I'm not mistaken, at West Virginia Christian Youth Camp, as I recall. And the friendship that we built through the years has been certainly one that I have treasured. When I found out Andy had taken a position as the director of this school, I was very, very pleased at what I heard, because I know he'll do a good job, know he is doing a good job, and it's a privilege for me to consider him my friend. Appreciate this school, all the good work that the school's doing here. I appreciate the good education that the young men are getting, and I've seen the benefit of the work in various places as I've dealt with the men who graduated from here. You're doing good work, and I want you to know how much we appreciate that. You know, it's hard to watch a good friend suffer. To stand at a hospital bed, or perhaps beside a hospital bed in a home, trying to deal with someone or help someone who perhaps is in hospice care and you know they're at the end, they know they're at the end. Or even if it's not to that extent yet, but you know they are in pain and the suffering that they're enduring because of the illness can be a hard thing to watch. You feel helpless. You want to ease the pain. But most of the time, just to be frank, there's not much you can do. And you try to come up with this the right thing to say, but it seems like any words that come to mind are wrong. Somehow you try to come up with what needs to be said, and what you end up saying is something that is hollow or trite. You say, and so far too many times, at least in your own mind, you go away having said the wrong thing and asking yourself, why in the world did I ever say that? Because you know it just was not what was appropriate or necessary at the moment. I suppose every one of us throughout our lives have known some that you might classify, as Job does his friends here, as miserable comforters. There's an old joke that was told of a lady who went in to visit a man at the hospital one time, and she asked the gentleman, what the doctor say, what's the diagnosis, and he told her, and she says, oh, my uncle had that, and he died. Now, we laugh at that, we snicker at that, but I actually heard that done. Several years ago, when I worked as a hospital chaplain, I remember being with a family one night in the emergency room. A denominational preacher came in and was standing there talking to this particular family, and this preacher looked at the lady in the bed and said, oh, it was just 3 years ago when we were here in the ER when your husband died of the very same thing. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. But you know what? We've all been there, haven't we? I remember standing at the head of my mother's casket a few years ago, it's calling ours, and a gospel preacher came by and shook my hand, and he looked at me and says, Phil, I'm so sorry about your mother, but hey, I guess that's the way it goes. Well, I don't think he meant to be insensitive. I don't think he meant that at all, but I'll tell you what it does is makes me wonder, have there been times that I have perhaps been the insensitive comforter, that perhaps what I said didn't come out just the way I meant for it to be? If I were to ask for a show of hands this afternoon, how many of you have ever said something that afterwards you wish you had not said in a situation like we're talking about tonight? How many of you would raise your hand? And if you do, I'm going to change my subject and start talking about lying. Because we've all done it. We don't like it, but we've done it. I just not long ago had to get on the phone and apologize to a friend of mine for a comment that I made that was not very sensitive. I didn't mean it to be insensitive, but just as soon as it came out of my mouth, I thought that was the wrong thing to have said in these circumstances, as he was dealing with a wife who was having some health issues. Now, fortunately, it went right over his head. He had not picked up on what I said, but he very easily could have, and I felt terrible. You've been there, haven't you? You know what I'm talking about. Job's friends desperately wanted to help him. I don't see anything in the book of Job that implies to me that these men intended to be unkind or mean or insensitive. I really think that their intentions were good. The Bible says in Job chapter 2 that they made an appointment to come together to comfort Job. They came together to mourn with him and comfort him, and I really believe that they had every intention of being helpful, but I also believe they were not prepared at all for what they found when they got there. When they arrived as a group, they found a man that they did not even recognize. A man so disfigured from the physical illness that he was with which he was struggling that he was literally unrecognizable. Found him sitting in sitting in the ashes with a piece of broken pottery in his hand, scraping whatever part of his body he could get to. Hopefully that by scraping off some of the sores and some of the scabs might gain a little bit of relief from the suffering that he was enduring. The sight was so overwhelming to them that the Bible says, Job 2 and verse 12, that they lifted up their voice and they wept. And then they sat down And for 7 days and seven nights, they said absolutely nothing. And that was the last right thing they did. We know very little about these men. The names were given, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. But all the indications are that they meant well. They came for the purpose, it says, of comforting him. Now, the word comfort in that passage is a word that literally means to sympathize or to show sympathy for. And they came out of a desire to show sympathy for Job and the suffering that he was enduring. Our English word comfort comes from two Latin words that means with strength. And the idea is that you come and provide strength to deal with the situation. You know, preachers, that's the best we can do in a funeral, isn't it? We go into a funeral, if you go into preaching a funeral with the idea that I'm going to say the magic words that are going to take all the grief and the pain and the heartache away, you're fooling yourself. Because those words don't exist. You can't say the things that are going to help that family stop hurting. They hurt and they're going to hurt until they've gone through the grief process. So what you hopefully can do in a funeral is go with comfort. Go with strength to help them deal with the grief until finally, time and time alone with God's help, heals that pain. Words at times can be more hurtful than helpful. And sometimes just being there is the best medicine in a difficult hour. But like Job's friends, far too often we feel the need to say something, and so we say something and then wish we hadn't. Job's the one who finally broke the silence with his famous speech that J.D. did such an excellent job with yesterday. Why me? And then Job's friends begin in chapter 4 to try to answer that question. Their well-intentioned but misguided attempts to comfort him showed a severe lack of understanding of the true nature of suffering in general and of Job's in particular. They did not have all the facts, but they spoke with great certainty anyway. They started with a false premise. And as is always the case, when you start with a false premise, you will reach false conclusions, and in this case, hurtful conclusions. Their personal attacks on Job merely added to Job's pain, to Job's grief, until he finally exclaimed in Job 16 and verse 2, "Miserable comforters are ye all." And then he asked him in verse 3, shall vain words have an end? You know what he's saying in that passage? He's just simply saying, If you can't do anything better than to accuse me of great wickedness, would you just please be quiet? You're not helping. Yes, we've all been in situations where we felt obligated to speak. We've all wondered if we said the right thing. Because no one with a Christian attitude or Christian heart wants to be a miserable comforter. So that brings me to the question I want to deal with this afternoon. How do we avoid the mistakes made by Job's three friends? What was it that made them miserable comforters, and how can we correct our thinking so that we don't make the same mistakes that they made? Well, I suggest to you this afternoon that their problems, that their mistakes stemmed from three sources. The first one is prejudice, not proof. They made up their mind based on what their prejudices taught them, regardless of what the evidence might say. Prejudice is determining your beliefs before you have all the facts. It's making up your mind prematurely, then clinging to those beliefs, even when you have absolutely no proof for their truthfulness. Job's friends had no understanding whatsoever, no knowledge whatsoever, of the facts behind Job's suffering. They knew absolutely nothing of the conversation that God and Satan had had in chapters 1 and chapter 2. They didn't have any clue of what was going on with all of that. And apparently, from what we read, made no effort to investigate and find out what was going on. Maybe they could have been better off if they'd used those 7 days of silence to do a little investigation, a little exploring to see exactly what it was that was causing Job to suffer. But they never even made an attempt, so far as we know. And so when Job challenged their prejudices, Eliphaz asked this question. Should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk or with speeches wherewith he can do no good? Now listen to that very carefully, what Eliphaz just said. Rather than listening to Job and hearing his side of the story, they accused him of uttering vain knowledge and making windy speeches. Sounds like some things coming out of Washington, D.C. sometimes, doesn't it? Vain knowledge and empty speeches. Apparently, they had made up their minds, and they didn't want to be confused with the facts. Their minds, what someone said, was very much like concrete, thoroughly mixed up and firmly set. Their prejudiced view caused them to reach a very definite wrong conclusion. Their prejudiced view said that suffering always results from sin. For example, in chapter 4, beginning in verse 7, Eliphaz says, "Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent. Or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and by the breath of his nostrils are they consumed. Whoever perished being innocent." Job, if you're suffering, obviously you're guilty. Or Bildad says this in chapter 8 and verse 20. "Behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers." What's the implication in that statement? God's cast away Job, therefore Job must not be a perfect man. Job is suffering, therefore he must be an evildoer. Or Zophar puts it this way in chapter 11, beginning in verse 5. "But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom." Now listen to this. If this isn't an unkind, harsh, and cruel statement, I don't know what is. Zophar says, "Job, I just wish that God would open his mouth and tell you what's really going on. That you would learn this, that your suffering, they are double to that, your wickedness, they are double to that which is. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth." Job, you're just getting a fraction of what you really deserve. How unkind can someone be? As a matter of fact, Bildad was so absolutely certain of his position that he actually was offended that God, Job did not accept their rebukes. He asked the question in 18:3, "Wherefore are we accounted as beasts and reputed vile in your sight?" Bildad is actually playing the victim here. He's got his feelings hurt that Job won't listen to his rebukes. You know, that's typical of prejudice. If I can't answer the argument, I attack the character. And that's exactly what these men are doing. Now, since they believe that sin is the only possible explanation for suffering, they set out to prove Job guilty of the wickedness and therefore deserving of everything that he got. It's interesting, as you read through these speeches that begin in chapter 4 and go all the way over to chapter 25, that time and time again they repeat the charges of sin against Job, but not one time do they offer one hint, shred of evidence proving him guilty of the things of which they are accusing him. Eliphaz does give Job a little bit of a compliment on one occasion. He tells Job that at one time you were a source of strength to the needy. "Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upheld him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees." Job, at one time you had things going pretty well, but somewhere along the line you turned your back on those noble principles and have changed things completely. And so Eliphaz tells him, "For thou hast taken a pledge from thy brother for naught, and stripped the naked of their clothing. Thou hast not given water to the weary to drink, and thou hast withheld bread from the hungry. Thou hast sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless have been broken." Talk about some unkind charges. To look at a man who is suffering to the extent that Job is, who has just lost his family, who has just lost his health, who has just lost everything he's owned in this world, and to tell that man what a wicked person you are, and give him this catalog of sins and offer no proof for it. Add to that, they also accuse Job of hypocrisy. After all, only a hypocrite would claim innocence in the face of such overwhelming evidence of guilt. Bildad said, "So are the paths of all that forget God, and the hypocrite's hope shall perish." Job, how hypocritical can you be sitting there, or perhaps lying there, telling us how in all that misery and telling us what a righteous person you are when we know better than that? Zophar said that Job's past blessings are the result of hypocrisy, and now that God had finally taken those things away from him. "Knowest thou not this of old? Since man was placed upon earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite but for a moment. Yeah, Job, you had things pretty well for a while. You had a pretty good collection of livestock over there. You had a nice family. Everything seemed to be going real well there for you for a while. But God knew who you really were, and God knew what was really in your heart, and he knew what a hypocrite you were. And so now he's taken that all away from you. You're just getting what you deserved. There's no evidence, but they continually attack Job's integrity in serving God. Now, brethren, those are serious charges, but offered with no evidence of Job's guilt. But then they didn't think they needed any evidence of Job's guilt. Their prejudiced views said that Job's suffering was in and of itself sufficient proof of his guilt. There was nothing more to be done, nothing more necessary to confirm their views that they were true in what they were saying. In chapter 31, beginning in verse 16, Job makes an attempt to explain away the charges they've just made. He denies them completely. He just flat out says they are not so. No, nobody has ever suffered at my hand. I have never withheld from the poor. I have never deprived the fatherless. I have never allowed anyone to die for a lack of clothing. Job does admit repeatedly in the book that he was not perfect. He never claimed sinlessness, but he maintained insistently that that his sin did not merit the level of suffering that he was experiencing on this occasion. No wonder Job called them miserable comforters. He deserved better in his darkest hour. But they were too committed to their preconceived ideas, and it kept them from being a real help to Job. Brethren, we need to be very, very careful in every situation, obviously, but in this one specifically, since it's what we're talking about this afternoon, that we are careful that we do not allow our own personal prejudices to interfere with the way that we deal with people. Just because we have all known of cases where suffering resulted from sin, and it does sometimes, doesn't it? I'll never forget sitting in the emergency room with a lady one night whose 18-year-old son was laying in the trauma room, probably not going to make it, and he didn't. And I remember her looking at me and saying, "Why did God let this happen?" And I didn't try to answer her question right then because I knew emotionally she wasn't ready. I knew the answer, but I knew she wasn't emotionally ready for the answer. But about 15 minutes later, she looked up at me and says, "I know why it happened. It wasn't God. It's that fifth of whiskey that he drank before he got behind the wheel tonight." Yeah, sometimes suffering does result from sin, doesn't it? But brethren, not all suffering results from sin. Let me give you an example. It's been pretty well proven, has it not, that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer, or can cause lung cancer. That's been proven. We know that. But are you also aware of the fact that 15% of lung cancer patients have never smoked a day in their life? And so it's not a fair assumption when you find out that someone has lung cancer to automatically assume they've been smoking. Maybe they haven't been. You may be basing your conclusion on prejudice, not proof. If suffering always results from sin, then somebody needs to explain two things to me. Somebody needs to explain to me that little 18-month-old baby that is suffering from cancer or some other illness. And somebody needs to explain to me the sufferings of Jesus Christ, the only sinless man who ever lived, who probably suffered more than any human being who has ever lived. It is possible to suffer in this world and for that suffering not to have anything to do with sin whatsoever. Some suffering is caused by sin, but not all. And it's unfair to the one suffering to draw a conclusion before we have all the facts. Number two, they were miserable comforters because they based their conclusions on tradition, not truth. Why did Job's friends believe that suffering is always a sign of sin? Where did they get that idea? Well, the answer to that's simple. They'd always been told that. Eliphaz claimed it was the wisdom of the ages. He said, asking Job, he says, "Art thou the first man that was born? Or wast thou made before the hills? Hast thou heard the secret of God? And dost thou restrain wisdom to thyself? What knowest thou that we know not? What understandest thou which is not in us? With us are both, now listen to this part. With us are both the gray-headed and very aged men, much elder than thy father. Job, you're talking here like you know something. Were you the first man ever born? You the oldest man on earth? Have you learned things that nobody else has learned? Do you know more than we do? Job, do you not understand that on our side of this issue are both the gray-headed and the very aged men? Some of those that hold our view are older than your father, Job. And anybody knows that a position that has come down from such well-respected gray heads and such well-respected age just has to be true. Job, how could you possibly argue with experienced old men who know so much more than you do? Can you possibly think you know more than they? Bildad even insisted that he learned this because of research that he had done. Actually, he challenged Job to do some research. He says in chapter 8, he says, "For inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and prepare thyself to the search of their fathers. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, because our days are upon the earth, are a shadow." Job, you and I aren't old enough to understand all of this. You and I aren't old enough to have learned all these things yet. So what we need to do is talk to those from the former age of the previous generation. Shall they not teach thee and tell thee and utter words out of their heart? Brethren, Eliphaz and Bildad here made a very common mistake. They believed something to be true because they had always believed it to be true. False views oftentimes are perpetuated because no one has thought to question their accuracy. Now, don't get me wrong. I think we obviously need to respect the wisdom that comes from age. And as my hair gets grayer and the birthdays start piling up, I really like that idea of respecting the age. But we also need sometimes to realize that the so-called wisdom of the ages may be more based more on tradition than truth. Just because a view is a, quote, time-honored view does not necessarily mean it's accurate. There have been a lot of things that have been traditionally believed through the years that absolutely are not so. It is difficult enough to find the right words to comfort a sufferer without falling prey to just parroting false views because they are commonly accepted. Traditional concepts of the cause of suffering have caused the most unfortunate things to be said by well-meaning people. I've been preaching very long, just a young man. I was teaching Wednesday night Bible study. A lady raised her hand. She had a question. Had absolutely nothing to do with what we were studying that night. But I know what she was trying to get me to do. Apparently, that day, her family had suffered a loss. Their puppy had died. Now, I know some of you can get really attached to a dog, and that dog can become a part of your family. I understand that. But when that puppy died, her response was to tell her 7-year-old daughter that that dog was in heaven. She knew better. And she spent a good portion of that Bible class that night, though, trying to get me to agree with her that she had done the right thing. She didn't get very far. She meant well when she told her little girl that. And I've heard people talk about their pets going to doggy heaven or kitty cat heaven. But those are traditional views, not truthful. I've also heard, and I bet you have too, someone's lost a loved one and somebody well-meaning put an arm around their shoulders and say, well, it was God's will. Now, I realize that's an attempt to help the sufferer cope. But brethren, it overlooks the biblical fact that suffering, illness, and death were never God's idea. They're Satan's idea. Death was not God's will. Or somebody stands and talks to a little girl in a funeral home beside her mother's casket. The little girl's trying to come to grips with why her mother is in that casket, and somebody looks down and says, well, God needed your mother more than you do. Now, why would that little girl not grow up hating God? Or I like this one. Well, God needed another angel. Which sounds so nice. But it completely overlooks the fact that the Bible teaches that angels were created as angels and not made out of righteous human beings. Those are not biblical ideas at all. Or someone says, well, it was just their time to go. Brethren, that's Calvinism. That's not Christianity. Or this one, and we've all been guilty of it, I'm afraid. With a well-meaning heart, we put an arm around someone's shoulder who's just lost a loved one, perhaps life's mate, and say, well, I know what you're feeling. I know what you're going through. No, you don't. One of the first things they told us as we began our training as a chaplain at the hospital was, you do not walk into any room and tell them, I know what you're feeling. Because even if you have had the very same illness or suffered the very same loss, it's not the same because the situations and circumstances are different in people's lives. And even if it is exactly the same, that person probably is not ready to hear it right now. And they're not going to believe you. Because one of the characteristics of grief is to believe that my grief is the worst grief that anybody has ever experienced. Nobody has ever hurt like I'm hurting, so you can't possibly know what I'm feeling. Now, there may come a time later on in which that same person will come to you and tap you on the shoulder and say, listen, I know you lost a loved one too. How did you deal with it? Now they're ready to talk. But far too often, we give these traditional answers that are not truthful. Their loyalty to what caused them, to what they had always taught and believed, caused them to increase Job's misery rather than provide comfort. Eliphaz even claimed to have searched the matter. Lo this, we have searched it. So it is. But for all the research that Eliphaz did, he'd drawn the wrong conclusions from his false premises. Brethren, those who are suffering don't need trite phrases repeated from generations that didn't understand suffering any better than we do. They need to be pointed to God's truth for the strength needed to outlast the suffering. But then also, the fact that they were miserable comforters stemmed from a haughtiness, not humility. Job's friends were absolutely convinced that Job's suffering was because of sin in his life. They were equally as convinced that they were the ones to help him correct that sin so the suffering would stop. Eliphaz promised him in chapter 22 that if thou return to the Almighty, thou shalt be built up, thou shalt put away iniquity far from thy tabernacles. For then shalt thou have delight in the Almighty, and thou shalt lift up thy face unto God, thou shalt make thy prayer unto him, and he shall hear thee. Job, if you'll just fess up to the sins of which we all know you're guilty, if you'll just quit hiding them and quit pretending and just come clean on this thing, then you can be right with God again. Zophar said, if thou prepare thine heart and stretch out thine hands toward him, if iniquity be in thine hand, put it far away, and let not wickedness dwell in thy tabernacles. For then shalt thou lift up thy face without spot, yea, thou shalt be steadfast and shalt not fear, because thou shalt forget thy misery, and thou shalt be secure, because there is hope. Yea, thou shalt dig about thee, and thou shalt take thy rest in safety, and thou shalt lie down, and none shall make thee afraid. Job, it can get better. Now, be honest, guys, gospel preachers, we've used this one, we use this one from time to time, and rightly so. You want your life to get better? Then you get it right with God, and it'll get better. But brethren, what Job's friends are trying to say here is, you've got to repent of sin, Job, even if you didn't commit any. And then things will get better. They intended to provide Job a sense of hope that his situation was not permanent. Yes, Job, you brought this misery on yourself. We all know that if you just admit it. But it could be made better if you'll just quit stubbornly denying the sin and return to God. Eliphaz even accused Job of a haughty, arrogant, rebellious attitude toward God by refusing to admit his sin. Shall a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk or with speeches wherewith he could do no good? Job, you need to just be quiet and quit trying to argue your way out of this thing and just admit what we all know is true. Or he asked this one, why doth thine heart carry thee away? And what do thy eyes wink at that thou turnest thy spirit against God and lettest such words go out of thy mouth? He implored Job to repent, and he assured Job that if he would do so, chapter 22 and verse 29, that God would save the humble person. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar meant to help, but their attitude was wrong. I want you to look at a passage with me over in the New Testament. Might have been helpful if they'd had this book of Galatians, these three men, so they could have read it. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. Apostle Paul, writing to the churches at Galatia, says, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Did you hear that? In a spirit of gentleness. There was nothing gentle about the speeches these three men made. They could only be characterized as harsh, unkind, even cruel. Gets even worse. Listen to this one from Bildad. If thy children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away for their transgression. Did you hear that one? Job, you lost 10 children in one day when a great east wind blew down the house where they were and killed all 10 of them instantly. They just got what they deserved. Talk about kicking a man when he's down. They falsely accused him of hypocrisy, of secret sin, of lacking compassion on the poor, of turning his back on God. Job said, How then comfort ye me in vain, seeing in your answers there remaineth falsehood? It's interesting to me, and I think in ways perhaps significant, that there are three rounds of speeches made by Job's friends. Eliphaz makes three. Bildad makes two and a piece. His last one's only 5 verses long. Zophar doesn't make a third speech. And I can't help but wonder if something took place here at one particular point. I can't help but wonder if Bildad just got started on number 3 and Job says, I'm done. That's it. He interrupted Bildad, didn't let him finish, and didn't give Zophar a third turn. He's heard about all of this, he wants to hear. And I base that on the fact that in the very next chapter, in Job chapter 26, Job starts in on a 6-chapter speech of his own, after which it is said, I'm done with you. He starts that speech out by saying, how hast thou helped him that is without power? How savest thou the arm that hath no strength? What have you fellas said in any one of your speeches that has been of any help to me whatsoever? So he's heard about all he wants to hear from these men. At chapter 32, verse 1, when he finishes that 6-chapter speech of his own, it says, so these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. He didn't give them another chance to talk. I mean, after all, they're starting to repeat themselves. And it wasn't true the first time around. Can you imagine the arrogancy of these three men who appointed themselves to be Job's judges? Eliphaz asked, shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? He even accused Job of believing that he could hide his sin from God. And thou sayest, how doth God know? Can he judge through the dark cloud? Thick clouds are a covering to him that he seeth not, and he walketh in the circuit of heaven. He's actually accusing Job here of believing that God couldn't see him on a cloudy day, and that somehow Job could hide what he was doing from God. Bildad rebuked Job for accusing God of being unfair. How long wilt thou speak these things? How long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? Doth God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? Bildad just is wondering here where Job got the nerve to consider himself wiser than those three friends. And in the last speech they make, Bildad says this, Dominion and fear are with him. He maketh peace in his high places. Is there any number of his armies? He's talking about God here. And upon whom doth not his light arise? How then can a man be justified with God, or how can he be clean that is born of a woman? Behold, even to the moon, and it shineth not. Yea, the stars are not pure in his sight. How much less man that is a worm, and the son of man which is a worm? Job, just compare yourself to God. Think who you're dealing with here, and realize that in comparison to God, you're nothing but a worm, and think about what that means. Maybe, Job, if you will just stop and realize that you are nothing more than a worm, you'll realize that you can't possibly be right with God. You'll humble yourself and admit your sin. Now think about that statement for just a moment. Apparently, they never realize that in condemning Job with this statement, they are condemning themselves. Listen to that. How much less a man that is a worm, and the son of man, which is a worm. How much less man, how can it be clean, a man be clean that is born of woman? Now, unless I'm seriously mistaken here, I think probably Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar were all born of women. If being born of a woman mean that you could not be clean in God's eyes, then were they not just as guilty of sin as was Job, and should they not have been suffering right alongside of Job? Had they not, with their false reasoning here, just accused or just condemned themselves as well as Job? Brethren, it takes a remarkable level of arrogance to strongly condemn somebody else of something that you are guilty of yourself. You know what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7? When he tells us, judge not that you be not judged. When he's saying you don't worry about picking the speck out of your brother's eye until you've got the beam out of your own eye. An unfair, judgmental attitude displays an arrogant superiority that makes it more difficult to reach the erring sinner. Job says, I expected better than that from you. Chapter 6 and verse 14 that Mark just did such an excellent job with, to him that is afflicted, pity should be shown from his friend. How long will you, these are questions Job's asking his friends. How long will you vex my soul and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times have you reproached me. You're not ashamed that you make yourself strange to me. How hast thou counseled him that hath no wisdom? I also could speak as ye do if your soul were in my soul's stead. Job says, I could talk to you just like this too if we trade places. I could heap up words against you and shake mine head at you if we just trade places. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the moving of my lips should assuage your grief. Question. I wonder. If the approach that they had used in dealing with Job is the one they would have wanted Job to use with them if the tables had been turned. Job had expected sympathy and support. Instead, they used Virgil's verbal sledgehammers to pound him into the ground. And somehow that was to be good for him. No, Job hadn't done anything to deserve this. As a matter of fact, God, speaking to Satan in chapter 2 and verse 3, told Satan, thou moved me against him to destroy him without cause. Even God said, Job doesn't deserve this. Job's friends never learned of the conversation between God and Satan. They never knew that he was not suffering because of sin, but because he didn't sin. They didn't know he was being used as a test case. They had reached their conclusion without the facts. They were absolutely certain, but they were certainly wrong. And God was angered by their lack of compassion and their unauthorized speaking for him. It's God who speaks to Eliphaz and says, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends. For ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. You know, that statement has to have shocked Eliphaz and his two friends. After all they had done to convince Job that he was of his sin, turns out he was right, they were wrong, and those gray-headed old men didn't know what they were talking about. God even characterizes in chapter 42 and verse 8, characterizes their speeches as folly, foolishness. And now, in what has to be in a classic case of poetic justice, Eliphaz, I want you to go ask Job to offer sacrifices on your behalf. And if you want to be right with me again, you're going to do it. That had to be a bitter pill to swallow. But they did it, and Job offered the sacrifices. In chapter 42 and verse 10, the Bible says, the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Job had not been swayed by their false ideas and false accusations. He stayed true to his God, and his rewards were great.